We've got a variety of topics with you for this week, from dealing with women who complain of low sex drive, to helping young infants with RSV, to a special look with GI problems that you might want to watch out for. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show, our podcast for nurses by nurses here. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you for checking out our program this week. We've got a great show for you coming up. First up in this week's episode, we have three special interviews on a variety of health and wellness topics. You could call it a potpourri episode, so we want you to stay tuned for the stuff coming up in just a bit. Before we get to into all that, though, I do want to make sure you follow up on what we talk about in this show and all our shows every week by heading over to nursingshow.com and checking out the links in each episode's show notes. There are also other articles and links to other things there. We have our free Nursing Show mobile app. We have a whole section on student nurse tips and study guides and aids. A lot of things over there. But follow up on what I talk about in the show with our guests each week and understand how it's applied using your own nursing scope of practice. If you have to get in touch with me, you can always drop me an email to nursingshow@gmail.com. I get a lot of emails in. I love to get them. I want to get more, so please send yours in. I respond back to all the emails that come in, so send me links to a news item or an interview idea or a research study or whatever, but keep those emails coming. Also, a very special thank you to both Physio-Control and the American Heart Association for partnering with The Nursing Show this month. You can find out more about it over at nursingshow.com, where there's links to all of the supporters of the program. That's it. I'll have some more contact information later on in this episode, but let's go ahead and get on into this week's nursing news items coming right up. First up, you know how fragile little babies' lungs are. There is a seasonal threat coming this time of year to those lungs. It comes out every year, and it's a leading cause of hospitalization for babies in the U.S. during their first year of life. So joining me now are Carrie Judson, mother and passionate RSV awareness advocate, and Dr. Gregory Sisson of Pediatrics Group of Georgia to help inform our nursing audience about severe RSV disease and the common signs and symptoms to watch for. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're concerned about with regard to viruses and young children this time of year?
Well, viruses in young children this time of year is the beginning of what we call RSV season, and RSV stands for respiratory syncytial virus. It's a very common respiratory virus. We all catch it as adults, and it may behave like a cold. And we all have had it at least once by the time we're 2 years of age. Children under a year of age, and the small children, the recent newborns, and the prematures that have been sent home from the NICU are the ones that have the highest risk and the most adverse outcomes. Those children can need their needs for hospitalization and the risks of dying from RSV are way higher in the less than year of population.
So, Carrie, you actually had some firsthand experience with RSV with your twins. Would you like to tell us a little bit and tell us your story of what happened?
Certainly. My twins were, first of all, born at 36 weeks and 2 days and at just over 4 pounds, which was those are both very healthy things for twins. They never went to the NICU. They were very healthy, came right home with me from the hospital. Didn't even have a cold, neither of them did, for the first year of their lives. And just before their first birthdays, they both contracted RSV. We discovered it in Alexander when he started looking listless, and we took him to a minor emergency center. That's when we discovered he had RSV, and he was not responding to breathing treatments. He was pediatric ambulanced to an Atlanta Children's Hospital, and later on that evening, he started to crash. After he was stabilized, he was airlifted to another Atlanta Children's Hospital and was put on life support, where we later found that he had lost brain function and he died from RSV. My living twin, Dominic, was in the hospital battling RSV disease for 11 days on oxygen, a majority of that time.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Even this many years later, I know it must be difficult for you to share this with us. And so I want to thank you on behalf of my audience, because we need to understand how important it is to be aware of this. Dr. Sisson, when the nurses come in contact with patients or talk to parents, and maybe they're not concerned about a little sniffle here or there with their patients, what kind of symptoms should we be telling parents to be on the lookout for?
It's really the progression of symptoms and how the symptoms evolve from a common cold type, you know, cough, congestion, and runny nose to symptoms where the breathing appears to be interrupted, the child appears to be listless, the child refuses feeds, there can be blueness around the lips and gums and tongue. When the child's refusing feeds and not taking from a bottle or not sucking on a pacifier, those are times where the child is actually trying to protect their airway and breathe in the face of all this congestion and blockage. When a child is not acting like the child that was there the day before, and you see that the downward progression, those are red flags that cause the need for evaluation by a doctor or the emergency room or the pediatrician.
Is there an age where we're more concerned, or when maybe they reach a certain point in their maturity where they're able to better withstand this virus?
Well, over the age of 2, the symptoms tend to progress more towards the common cold in an adult, where they're not as adversely affected. And then under 2, but particularly under 1, and the recent newborns are the ones where you really have to be concerned that the child may become adversely affected.
Is there anything the other family members can do to help protect passing on something to an infant that lives in the home with them?
Well, in remembering that the season is between October and April, this is a high time for holiday visits. So limiting exposures to sick contacts. And if people are sick or have been around other sick people, aggressive hand washing is always a good thing. And hand washing, keeping counters clean, all those things will protect.
Excellent. Carrie, when you talk to other parents about this and you know, parents of premature infants specifically, what do you tell them to help protect their children?
Number one is be your child's advocate. You are the mouthpiece for your baby who can't talk. They can't tell you when they can't breathe. If they are acting differently than they have been in the past, then something is probably wrong. And generally, as a parent, you know when that happens. At that point in time, take them in. Go see your pediatrician. Go see your family doc, whomever you see. But don't risk it. Take them.
And Dr. Sisson, I think I speak for most healthcare professionals out there. We don't mind seeing children that are sick just to be sure that it's not something more serious.
Not at all. And sometimes this is an illness that can progress. So a child that may just seem like they're a little bit sick on a Monday, you know, Wednesday, Thursday comes around, and then all of a sudden they've changed. They're not feeding as well. Watching the child behave, is the child still playful and engaging? Or is this a child that's refusing feeds and looking not themselves, listless? Those are the keys and clues we're looking for.
So, Doctor, where can I send my nursing audience to find out more information and kind of back up their knowledge and resources on this?
RSVprotection.com is a website that has, it's basically a clearinghouse with all the symptoms, signs, things we can do to prevent, as well as getting a handle on when the season is.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you both on behalf of my audience. This is important information to get out there, and we'll make sure we share it with our colleagues as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have a look at helping women with low sex drive. For some women, this may be a sign of an underlying health condition. As nurses, we're taught to look at the whole patient, and that includes their sexual health and wellness. So a new national survey has actually revealed that about half of women are having lower sex drive than in the past, and they're just dealing with it, despite the resulting strain on their relationships and their overall well-being. I talk with Dr. Leah Milheiser. She's the clinical assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University. She chats with me to help educate women on this under-discussed health condition and ways to help women find the confidence to talk with their health professionals, like nurses, about their sexual concerns. great to have you here. This is The Nursing Show, Dr. Millhiser. It's a program for nurses, nurse practitioners, and students. And, you know, it's interesting. When I saw this topic come across my desk, I almost passed on it because I'm a guy. What do I know about women's sexuality? But I also said I'm a nurse, and I have to manage all patients that come to me and help them manage anything that might be a problem for them. So, Let's dig right into this, because I think that culturally women have been discouraged from seeking a healthy sex life.
Yeah, you know, I don't disagree with you there at all. I think we have, unfortunately, there's been an environment where women have been made to feel like it's not appropriate to talk about their sexual functioning. But I will tell you, I was around, you know, in the medical field when Viagra was approved. And I think Viagra for one reason, and that one reason is that it really opened up the door to doing research into what female sexual dysfunction is and to try and identify solutions for it. So I think we now live in a time where women are becoming more empowered to talk about their sexual function. Clinicians are learning more about sexual function, so healthcare providers. And interestingly, nurses and nurse practitioners are often the front line in talking to women about sexual health and wellness. So I'm so happy to be on your show today talking about it.
So let's kind of address this. Is why is it so important? I mean, is a healthy sex life that important? I know we talk about holistically approaching our patients, and sexuality is part of that. Is it just a simple aspect of patient health, or does it have more to it?
You know, I consider it a part of health and well-being for women. The majority of women who come to see me in my practice will say, my sexual function, my sex life with my partner is equally important as the other issues that we're addressing in the clinic visit today. So I would say, yes, it is important. And when we look at women who have challenges in their sexual function, so I'm going to use as an example low sexual desire, think of it as like tentacles that infiltrate every woman, every aspect of that woman's life. So low sexual desire can impact her self-esteem, her body image, her relationship with her partner, the way she interacts with her peers at work, her friends, her family. And this has all been diagnosed or documented in research studies. So we know it's incredibly important to identify these concerns and address them in the clinical setting.
So if someone does approach us and talk to us about having low sexual desire or not feeling in the mood, is this actually a sign of a medical condition?
Yeah, you know, I like to kind of separate this into two buckets. The answer is yes, it can be a sign of a medical condition. But let's look at both sides here. It's very normal for women throughout their life to have waxing and waning levels of sexual desire. Take the woman who's been in a relationship for 20, 30, 40 years. Novelty is gone. So women say, it's just not that exciting anymore. I'm not always in the mood for it. That's when it's important to look at, well, what can I do to sort of lively things up or add novelty back into the bedroom? Or take the woman who's a multitasker. She's got a full-time job. She has children in the home. She's a partner. She's got three jobs. And then at the end of the night, all she wants to do is collapse on the bed because she's exhausted. Fatigue and stress are killers to sexual desire. Now take that same woman and have her go on vacation to Bora Bora with her partner, and wow, all of a sudden sparks are flying again. So we know that there are these normal changes that women can experience. Now we look to the women who have female sexual dysfunction. They don't have that waxing and waning. They have chronic issues with their sexual function. So I always like to look at hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which is the most common type of sexual dysfunction. It's what I have done the most research in my institution. And really, think of it as a woman who has absent to low sex drive. It's been there for 6 months or longer. Vacations, perfect relationships, date nights don't make it better. And it's very bothersome to her. It causes her distress. That's when we have to look at, is this sexual dysfunction? And now what are we going to do to address that issue?
So you're telling me, like so many things we do in healthcare, it really comes down to having a good history-taking technique and good patient assessment skills.
Absolutely. You know, the diagnosis of HSDD, or hypoactive sexual desire disorder, is made through just like you said, a really good history taking and discussion with the patient. Now, unfortunately, what's happening is a lot of women are suffering in silence. We know that 44% of women have a sexual concern, of which many of those women do indeed meet criteria for sexual dysfunction, but they feel like there's nowhere they can go. There's no one they can talk to. They're embarrassed to talk to their healthcare provider, and they shouldn't be. There's actually this fantastic new website. It's called findmyspark.com. And it's an educational initiative that was created by the American Sexual Health Association with funding or support from Valiant. And what they did is they brought together a group of experts in the field of women's sexual health to provide resources that give education on what is female sexual dysfunction, how do I know I might have it, how do I open up a conversation with my healthcare provider so that I can get information about solutions, both medical and psychological. So findmyspark.com is a really great place to go as an initial step for women who may feel like they're not ready to talk to their healthcare provider. But I would advise every woman with a concern to speak to their provider. Your provider wants to know, as you well know in the nursing field, you want to know what your patient is experiencing, because not only is a sexual concern important in that it may be female sexual dysfunction, but it may also be a sign of another underlying medical condition. So important for women to share their concerns with us and for us as providers to be asking the question.
Yeah, I love having great resources like this to be able to share with patients to keep them from doing their own random searches on the web, but we can give them good resources to turn to when they might have an issue. So Dr. Millhiser, thank you so much. We'll make sure we have a link to that in the show notes for this episode. And from my nursing audience to you, thank you for sharing some time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Finally, digestive issues are things that many of us can relate to, at least some of the time. They're unpleasant, and we don't often like to talk about symptoms we might be having due to fear or embarrassment. But what if that stomach ache you or a patient complains of isn't just a stomach ache? What if it's a sign of an underlying problem that's rare but treatable, called EPI? I chat with Dr. Phil Hart about why it's important for people to speak candidly with their healthcare professionals about their gastrointestinal issues, and why digestive health should be a health priority for everyone.
Jamie.
Hi, Dr. Hart. Welcome to the Nursing Show. This is a program online for nurses and nurse practitioners and students in the nursing field. And so I want to welcome you to the show. We're talking about digestive health and digestive issues. And I think it's important because we get all kinds of things asked of us as healthcare professionals from people we know, from our patients and everyone else. And I'm sure there's several things you'd like to talk about. But what are some of the common GI issues and symptoms that we might be running into?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, Jamie. So you're right. GI symptoms are incredibly common. In fact, it's estimated that about 60 to 70 million people in the United States have chronic digestive symptoms. And these symptoms can really be pretty wide-ranging, from things like abdominal bloating, gas, to changes in their stool patterns.
Now, I mean, a lot of people will, you know, complain of general GI problems, but sometimes they're reluctant to share that information. In your practice, what's been some of the reasons that people have kept people from telling a health professional about a problem they're having?
Yeah, there are probably a variety of reasons. In fact, with the support of the American Gastroenterological Association, we recently conducted a large survey to try to better understand these sorts of things. And one of the most striking findings from this survey was that patients waited on average 4 years to discuss their symptoms with their healthcare providers. And of those patients that had a difficult time discussing these things, 60% cited embarrassment as the primary reason behind that. And in my personal clinical practice, I would say that embarrassment is hands down the number one reason that patients have a difficult time with these conversations.
So what have you done to try to ease that? I mean, is there recommendations for us to try to help patients overcome that embarrassment, or set up create a scenario where they can feel more comfortable telling somebody about their problem?
There are a variety of things that can be done, I think, to address this problem. First, we want to encourage patients, though, to be proactive and to take this into their own hands. And if they are suffering from these GI symptoms, to discuss them with their healthcare provider. As a healthcare provider, I think that it's important to ask about all of these possible symptoms in the appropriate context. And then when patients do endorse the symptoms, to help normalize the symptoms and help them to understand, like I said, that these symptoms are incredibly common and nothing to be ashamed of.
So we're talking about EPI today. And so tell me a little bit about what EPI is and why it's something that we need to be more aware of. Yeah.
So EPI stands for exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, and this refers to a condition where the pancreas doesn't make or release enough enzymes or chemicals to help the pancreas participate in its normal digestive role in response to the food that we eat. This is important for a variety of reasons. Number one, as we discussed earlier, this is a common source of symptoms, or of these common symptoms, and importantly, it's something that's very treatable. The other thing is that in patients that have EPI, there are often other problems that can occur related to the underlying disease of the pancreas that require further attention. So there are multiple reasons that identifying EPI is important.
So, you know, making sure we keep an eye out for somebody complaining of some diverse GI symptoms and referring them to seek some professional assistance from a specialist like yourself if they do exhibit these problems.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
So when you talk about EPI, what are some of the ways that patients can get this treated? You said it's common and that people should seek treatment because it can be treated. What are some of the ways that people find
sure.
a way to get take care of this problem?
So even though EPI isn't all that common, one of the important reasons that we think patients should be aware of this as a possible explanation for their symptoms is that it's highly treatable. And the way that EPI is treated is by taking medications that are referred to as pancreatic enzymes. And patients take these enzymes whenever they eat food. And in essence, this replaces the digestive role of the pancreas.
So it's a food supplement that they can get prescribed to them, and it's something that they would then use, and it alleviates the symptoms. That's great. If they wanted to find out more about this, or my nurses wanted to have a resource they could share with patients when they're doing education and things like that, where can they send folks to find out more about EPI?
Sure. Some helpful online resources are at identifyepi.com as well as gastro.org.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Hart, thanks for taking some time with my audience of nurses today, and we appreciate you sharing this information with us, and we'll make sure we add those resources links to the things we share with patients every day.
Great. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
That's going to close out this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week. Make sure you follow up, though, on all of the information you picked up in this episode. Head over to nursingshow.com and check out the episode show notes. There's a link right there at the top of the page. In there are listings for all of the episodes of The Nursing Show. From the most recent one at the top, you can scroll down and go all the way back to the very first episode. But I want you to get the full information there with links to other resources so that you understand how to apply what you hear on the show to your own nursing practice or studies. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email. You can send that in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email that comes in, and I want to hear from you. So send me your comments, your questions, suggestions, news links. Help support the Nursing Show community with your input. You can also get the Nursing Show email newsletter. There's a link and form right on the right-hand side of the Nursing Show site, so fill out that short form, and we'll send you the links to each episode's show notes directly to your email inbox each week. You can also connect with me on social media sites. I'm available there under the handle PodMedic, so you can find me there under twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic, so friend or follow me. You can also become a member of the community over on Facebook by liking the Nursing Show Facebook page at facebook.com/nursingshow. Click the like button there and join the conversation on that page. I post other nursing and healthcare articles and pictures on the Nursing Show site throughout the course of each week and over at the Nursing Show page, so check it all out. That's it for me. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. I'll be back with more episodes here of The Nursing Show. Remember, it comes out every Friday for you, so you can wrap up your nursing week. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show.